This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Well, hello and welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's Kennedy in for Kilmeade. He is off on assignment doing very important Kilmeadian things. He is enjoying life. He is gathering facts, which he will bring back to you and share them like seashells from a faraway beach. And while we eagerly and tearfully await his return, until then, I will be in his stead in the Brian Kilmeade Control Center, which is both intoxicating and intimidating. And I'm very happy to be here. If you don't know me, I'm one of Brian's colleagues here at Fox News. I do a podcast, Kennedy Saves the World, which you can find on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you find your podcasts. You can even go to foxnewspodcast.com and you can download every single episode I've ever done and make your life infinitely better, for which I high five you. Something that is going to get infinitely worse is New York City. And it's very sad because we have an adorable dimple-faced socialist who won the primary recently, and he is now the official Democrat candidate for mayor here in New York City. And it is incredibly problematic because there used to be a time where we would say the word socialist pejoratively. That would be an insult. That would be a facial disgrace against someone you thought had really bad ideas that were going to tank the economy and whatever system of government they were seeking to lead. Socialism is bad. It has proven itself to be bad over and over and over again. If you are like me, then you have a parent who moved to the United States from a country that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, where everything was taken from them and all of their economic and cultural prospects dissolved essentially overnight after World War II. My mom and her family came over from Romania, and so I have always learned about politics and economics through sort of an anti-commie lens. And I'm very grateful to my family for that, because I was also raised to believe that this country is one that's filled with opportunity. And in order for opportunity to blossom in your life, and this was really on the part of both of my parents, you had to work hard. And my dad, you know, used to joke that people would tell him, "Oh, you're so lucky." Whenever he found his way to good fortune, they would always say, "Oh, you are so lucky." And he would say, "Yes, the harder I work, the luckier I get." So there was always a direct proportion between what you put into life and your passions and your profession, you would get out of it. And that's the thing about the United States, is it has always been unashamedly aspirational. And that is a wonderful thing, because if there is a direct proportion between how hard you work and what you get out of it, and that doesn't necessarily have to mean money or possessions, that could mean satisfaction, fulfillment. Well, socialism is the opposite of that, because socialism demonizes things, and particularly private property. So, you know, that seems in theory like a great idea. Like, why should all the rich people have the stuff? Well, private property, that could be your condo. That could be whatever you have in your backpack. That could be your car that you finally paid off. Because when you work hard to secure something, that makes it yours. And for some people, the idea of working hard enough to finally buy their own home and have a place where they can have stability and roots and hopefully something to pass down to their family, that is the American dream. That is the ultimate aspiration. But unfortunately for socialism, they have this idea of redistribution, of taking the fruits of the labor of people who worked very, very hard for something and giving it to the people who have fewer fruits, for people whose lives are based on the zero-sum prospect that we only have one thing. And therefore, if people are hoarding it like so many cats in a garage, then that stuff has to be rescued and given out to various cat ladies who only have four cats, and now they need five or six. So that is the promise and the strategy of Zoran Mamdani. The problem with socialism is it has been tried over and over and over again, and it has failed over and over again, not just in Romania and Vietnam and North Korea, but Venezuela and Cuba and parts of the world where people flock away from, and they fly to the United States so they can also engage in the aspiration, because they have had things taken away from them. They have had everything taken away from them. So if you know that something is going to be taken away from you, as your stuff flies out of your possession, so does the incentive to work harder and make more. These economies and these countries tend to collapse on the backs of great promises. So with the repetitive failures, you would think that we would stop trying. But there are zero-sum socialists who will never stop trying, because it is like a cult. And they have been brainwashed that this political fetish is the only way to right the economic injustices in the world, when actually it exacerbates them. So what do? You have to repackage it. You have to repackage it in different people with slightly different messages, and it all adds up to a big lie. So the most famous Democrat socialist, obviously, is Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders always gets a lot of traction because of his authenticity. And then AOC, she's like the attractive physical female embodiment of Bernie Sanders, who just repeats and parrots his talking points. But, you know, she's in the House of Representatives, and there are a lot of colleagues against her who sort of neutralize the claptrap. Unfortunately, Zoran Mamdani has a really great shot at leading New York City right off a cliff. But don't take my word for it. Here's the repackaged, super cute version of this sanitized socialism that will be just as destructive. Here's clip 20, Zoran Mamdani himself.
And we know that this is all happening within a larger national context, where Donald Trump is seeking to make it even more expensive to raise a family in this country. It is our responsibility to move beyond the broken politics of the past of our city and our state, and start to offer an alternative across this country.
So there are a couple things here which are a lie, that Donald Trump is seeking to make it even more expensive to raise a family in this country. I disagree. And that's why the tax cuts were so incredibly important, because with a greater tax burden comes less economic immobility. The more you owe to the government, the less money you have to save money for your dream house or save money to start a business. And then when you do start a business, there are people with this mentality that want to take everything you have, essentially, because, you know, in the words of Barack Obama, you didn't build that. Yeah, you did, because without you, the business would not exist at all. So you did build that. And the more successful your business becomes, the more people you are able to hire. So Donald Trump, and the reason, and you may disagree about this, because I've never been a big fan of tariff wars, but the reason he is so dead set against a trade deficit with other countries is they are charging more money for the U.S. to engage with their goods, and that makes things more expensive. So what Donald Trump wants is a neutral trade relationship, so we are not paying more for things like prescription drugs. That's why the tariffs are so high, potentially for Switzerland, which makes a lot of prescription drugs. And even though those drug companies may be able to sidestep some of the higher tariffs that will befall the neutral nation, it's because there are Swiss companies who charge a lot more for the United States to buy certain drugs. Donald Trump wants to take care of that by creating a neutral trade environment, so consumers in the United States aren't paying any more for prescription drugs than consumers in Canada or Mexico or Europe or anywhere else in the country are, because that is unfair. They are passing higher costs on to American families. So if American families are paying a lot more for prescription drugs because of a trade deficit, then that makes it more expensive. So if things are cheaper because things are fair and they're not gouging U.S. consumers, that actually makes it more affordable. If Donald Trump is harassing Jerome Powell to lower interest rates, that's so the interest rates come down on money that you borrow so people can now afford to buy homes. Because what happens in the housing market? Well, as interest rates go up, homeowners who are sitting on 3% 30-year mortgages, they're not going to sell them when interest rates are 6 and 7% because they can't get a mortgage after that. They can't even make a lateral move. So, yes, you may disagree with him and call him Timu Hitler and an orangutan and a fascist and everything else, but his policies would directly lead to more affordability for American workers. He's also trying to repatriate a lot of investments from, you know, especially countries in the EU. So they build factories and invest in American manufacturing here. So there are more American jobs. If more Americans have jobs, more Americans can afford things. So that undercuts one of Zoran Mamdani's premises. You know, he's also talking about the broken politics of the past. The broken politics of the past are very, very recent. You just have to look at Bill de Blasio. And what was Bill de Blasio's New York like? It was more dangerous than Rudy Giuliani or Michael Bloomberg, unfortunately. And, you know, women didn't feel safe walking alone at night. And schools were out of their minds with political correctness. And there were mandates to force feed certain ideological bents that families found offensive. So, yes, New York City was less safe. There were more homeless people. There were fewer arrests. There were fewer cops. Cops were demonized. Those are the broken politics of the past. What Zoran Mamdani is offering, you know, for a guy who wants to defund the police and abolish prisons and not really do anything about homelessness or mentally ill drug addicts and actually getting them help, that will be exacerbated. So, in addition to all that, buses would be free, grocery stores would be city run, which means you have to have a phenomenal tax base. That means you have to raise taxes on rich people. If rich people think their taxes are going to go up, they are going to go to a more tax-friendly climate because they want to keep what they have worked for. And so they are going to go to places like Tennessee, Florida, Texas, and Nevada, where they don't have a state income tax. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to another senatorial commie, Elizabeth Warren. Here she is sparring over Zoran Mamdani's tax plan and Cut 22.
What Zoran is saying is, I want people to be able to afford to live in New York City. That's what keeps it a vibrant city. That's what makes people want to live
Nobody
here.
Nobody disagrees with that, Senator, but raising taxes in order to do it?
Oh,
why is that
goodness.
The answer?
Oh, dear. Are you worried that billionaires are going to go hungry?
No, I'm worried that they're going to leave and spend their money elsewhere.
You know, they've threatened to do that over and over and over.
And they have. They've left.
I love that. They actually have, Elizabeth. They have left. All you have to do is talk to the billionaires who have relocated to Florida from New York and New Jersey. And if you talk to anyone in this city of means since Mamdani won the Democrat nomination, they are all ready to go in ways that they have never, ever been interested in doing. And incredibly conceited for Elizabeth Warren to think that magically through her goodwill and doing what's right in this pragmatic socialism that you will in fact invite billionaires to stay in New York. You won't. You are sending them a handwritten invitation to leave, which means that the people are left are the ones who cannot afford to go anywhere. So you have middle-income and lower-income New Yorkers who will be facing a much larger tax burden, which means they can make fewer choices on their own, and they're going to be plagued with higher crime, more homelessness, unsafe streets, unfettered prostitution, which if you want to make it legal, don't do it in the way that it is metastasizing in AOC's district right now, because that is unconscionable and inhumane. The entire enterprise is a horror show, but because he has been repackaged slickly, because he has this magnetic smile and way of delivering things that sound almost pretty good, you've got younger voters who are willing to take a shot and roll the dice. But they will come up snake eyes. They will lose, and it will be a disaster for New York City. It is a contagion that has already spread from Portland and Minneapolis to Chicago, and we do not need it here. So, you know, worst case scenario, I guess we could all flee to Illinois like Texas Democrats. We'll get into that in moments right here on The Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Kennedy.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
They understand the importance of standing for what democracy is and making sure that it does not fall by the wayside. They understand that we have a Timu Hitler in the White House right now that thinks that he is going to become the dictator of the United States.
Oh, that's Jasmine Crockett. She is a congresswoman from Texas. And she is just spitting mad because Republicans are eager to redraw the congressional map in Texas. And hopefully their hope is that they give themselves five more seats. New York and California have threatened to retaliate in kind and redraw their map. So gerrymandering will be the hottest trend for the next year and change to see how much both parties can influence the midterms. As you know, Texas Democrats fled to Illinois. So their corpulent governor can act as a human shield between Republicans in the state out and in the Lone Star State and the fleeing Democrats who are trying to deny a legislative quorum by taking their bodies out of the state. They could be fined $500 a day. They're now talking about arresting the offenders. They don't care. They just want to do whatever they possibly can to stand up against this map redraw, which I cannot stand in any state. It is the most hypocritical issue because, you know, if you're a Republican and they're going to redraw it, so it benefits you, it's great. If you're a Democrat, you hate it, unless the shoe is on the other foot. The shoe stinks. It's a Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is the key that really blows the whole Obama, Hillary, Brennan, Clapper, Comey narrative out of the water, where they say that Russia aspired to help Trump get elected, or that Russia hacked the election in favor of Donald Trump, really trying to discredit President Trump's win.
Yes.
And give a big middle finger to the American people who had just voted him into office.
That would be our Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. And she has been making a lot of waves by declassifying some of the documents regarding Russiagate and its origins from back in 2016. And, you know, like the promise of economic prosperity under socialism, this was all a big, giant lie. How did it happen and how can we keep it from happening again? There is one journalist who has been deeply diving into all of this subject matter for quite a few years, Matt Taibbi. He is Racket News editor-in-chief. He has a phenomenal Substack that you should subscribe to. And he has been phenomenal at getting to the bottom of all of this stuff. And Matt Taibbi, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's your friend Kennedy.
Hey, Kennedy. How's it going?
It's going good. So this stuff, it really does scare me because you see how different elements of the federal government can come together to just try and railroad someone out of the presidency or railroad them right into prison, as was the case of George Papadopoulos and others. Where did you first stand on Russiagate when we started to hear about it in 2016? I'm guessing you were still writing for Rolling Stone then?
I was, yeah. But my immediate reaction to the story was that it sounded wrong. I wrote a story in late December of 2016 right away saying the headline was something about this Russia story stinks. Did not make a lot of friends in the business for saying that. And my calculation about this was, this is either the biggest intelligence coup of all time, where the Russians got a Manchurian candidate into the White House, or it's the biggest intelligence fraud of all time on our side. But I could not imagine that the CIA, the FBI, the White House, and everybody in the media could be in on, you know, a deception that big. So it took a long time to wrap my head around the whole thing.
So for journalists who had access to more of the facts than maybe you or other skeptics did at the time, were you surprised that the New York Times and the Washington Post ignored some of these red flags that in another time with another subject might have resulted in very different reporting?
Absolutely. I mean, especially the New York Times, which had just been through a terrible reputation-destroying ordeal with the WMD episode, where it was essentially the same story. They were being told by unnamed intelligence community officials that there was evidence of something, but they couldn't see it. They weren't shown what was inside the box. And they went to print with this, and they later had to admit publicly that, you know, they had been deceived, that there was a national intelligence estimate that was published that suppressed all the dissenting information. They had to report on their own mistakes in that case. And everybody in the business after that thought, well, we can't ever do that again. We can't ever do this huge story where we're told by unnamed people familiar with the matter and not check it. But they did it. They did it all over again. And this one was actually a worse scandal, I would say.
I would tend to agree with you. But, you know, I keep going back to the beginning and I'm trying to pinpoint what the impetus was. Was it something cooked up by President Obama to make sure that his legacy stayed intact? Was it something that generated from the intelligence community, particularly from John Brennan, so their version of the deep state wouldn't be infringed upon by such an anti-establishment person like Donald Trump? Was it an insurance policy to make sure that Hillary Clinton won? Or was it something else or a combination of those things?
I think it was a combination of a bunch of things, and there are two key dates to remember, and there are still some gray areas about what exactly happened at those times. The first one is at the end of July in 2016, when the FBI opened its Crossfire Hurricane probe into Donald Trump. Now, the official explanation for this is that an Australian diplomat talked to a Trump aide named George Papadopoulos, who allegedly said something about dirt on Hillary Clinton. That turned out not to be true much later. It now looks, because of the Durham report, like they had significant information much earlier about Russian plans or Russian communiques saying that Hillary Clinton had a plan to sort of vilify Donald Trump by tying him to Russia. It's not clear what happened, but whatever reason it was to start that investigation in the summer of 2016, it wasn't what they said it was. The other one is December 8th, 2016, when Obama suddenly commissioned a new intelligence community assessment that basically said Russia meddled in the election to help Donald Trump specifically. That was new, and we still don't know why he did that.
So that was really interesting. And, you know, I look at that when Obama inserts himself, and that was when everyone underneath Brennan tried to talk him out of it and say that, you know, we don't have enough here to justify what this will, you know, opening the lid on this, what it will unleash into our politics and our media. And Brennan famously said, yes, but it rings true, doesn't it? It's like, well, there's not enough there to ring true. But, you know, looking back at this, did Obama think that if they were able to construct this convincingly, would that undo the results of the election, somehow create a constitutional crisis and make Hillary Clinton the victor? Was that the point, or was that just to take Trump out of the presidency, do you think?
Well, I don't think we know yet. Obviously, this just went to the grand jury yesterday, and there, you know, Tulsi Gabbard was pretty adamant that we have to get indictments, and you know, the names that are being bandied about are James Comey, Jim Clapper, and John Brennan, some other folks. But we don't know. We still don't know what the motivation for all this was. What we do know is exactly what you said, which is that the people who were doing the work on this assessment, you know, I think quite rightly were panicked. They were saying, we can't use this stuff. This is going to, you know, this is going to be out there forever. And, you know, our careers are going to be ruined if we use phony campaign research to start this. But I think the circumstantial evidence suggests that what this assessment was for was to create the precondition for an investigation of Trump that would lead to an impeachment. I think everything points to that, but we still don't see the full preparations for that in documentation.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, from what you know, will the grand jury have access to more than we have been given that has recently been declassified so far?
Absolutely, yes. They're going to be looking at a lot of things. I've only had one conversation with somebody about this so far, but there's still an enormous amount of material that has not been released to the public, including the raw interviews that went into the Durham report, the raw interviews that went into the report that Tulsi released by the House Intelligence Committee. There's also an enormous amount of hacked material that we retrieved from the Russians that talks about this Clinton plan to vilify Donald Trump, and we haven't seen those raw materials yet either. There's a lot of speculation about why that was never looked at. The FBI went to great lengths not to look at that material officially. So all that stuff, I'm assuming, is going to come into play. And the way the investigators are talking suggests to me that they have something that they think is convincing. But again, you know, we can't say that definitively without knowing what it is.
Yeah. And, you know, George Papadopoulos said adamantly the opposite of what the FBI had claimed was the basis for the investigation. And they knew that. They also knew that the Steele dossier was very, very dubious at best. But those were the two hooks that they were willing to hang this investigation on. And, you know, I still go back to Carter Page, who offered to come into the FBI, and, you know, he voluntarily wanted to come in for an interview. And they said no, because they were spying on him, and they were spying on him because the FBI, when they issued the FISA warrant request, didn't tell the judge that Carter Page was working with the CIA, which would have negated the wiretap.
Of course, yeah, no, and that was illegal, and he was criminally convicted. The lawyer that did that was criminally convicted. And look, I think a lot of people on the Democratic side roll their eyes at this and they say, what's the big deal? But think about the comparison between this and Watergate. Watergate was a story about political espionage bugging the opposition party in the middle of a presidential campaign. And that's what this is. They illegally obtained surveillance authority on the entire Trump world through this FISA. People who don't know how FISA works, it's a multiple hop technology that allows you not only to see the communications of that person, but everybody that Carter Page talked to and everybody that those people talked to. So they got visibility into the whole Trump campaign illegally, and they were leaking phony intelligence, which is as bad as the dirty tricks from the Nixon era. So, and that's just the pre-election behavior.
I would argue that it's worse because of all the entities that were involved, you know, the CIA, the FBI, the DNI, the vice president, the Democratic nominee for president, who was also the former Secretary of State. You didn't have that with Watergate. And, you know, it's a shame that Gate is now tagged on to everything. So we get Russiagate, and it's because of the Watergate Hotel where the break-in was. But this is so much bigger. I wish there were a name for this entire catastrophe that could then be tagged on to every scandal in the future.
Yeah, it is frustrating. And you're right. You know, Watergate, one of the things that was really interesting about Watergate is that it was committed by this group that was inside the White House, because they couldn't rely on the CIA or the FBI or these other agencies to do their dirty work for them. Nixon had to rely on people inside his own White House because it was so unthinkable to ask agencies to do this kind of stuff.
Because they knew it was wrong and they wouldn't do it. Unlike Obama's CIA and Obama's FBI, which were essentially lapdogs using all of their heft and their surveillance capabilities that we knew we were wrong since the Snowden era. And this is what civil libertarians were warning against when we learned about all of that stuff.
And that was a frustrating aspect of it for me, Kennedy, was, you know, I was always a big proponent of civil liberties, you know, at Rolling Stone. You know, FISA and, you know, the national security letters that the FBI used and all the other tools that came out of the war on terror. I always was warning. I said, this is way too much power to give to the federal government. They can spy on anybody without almost any oversight whatsoever. And there's going to be an enormous temptation to use this for political reasons. But as soon as Donald Trump entered the picture, civil libertarians forgot all of their objections to these issues. They forgot that they didn't like FISA. They forgot that they didn't like this enhanced international surveillance state. But you see what happens when, you know, people are allowed to use this and there's no oversight. This is what happens. And that's why it's so important to litigate this thing all the way through.
Can you stay with me for just a couple minutes more? We're going to take a quick break, but I want to get into the talking points pushing back against this recent declassification and the grand jury. And where do we go from here to make sure this doesn't happen again? Matt Taibbi, can you stay with me for a few minutes?
Yep, absolutely.
This is a phenomenal day here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Kennedy.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Kennedy back on the Brian Kilmeade Show, filling in for Brian. O-D-O-T-O, one day, one time only. I'm talking with Matt Taibbi. He is an investigative journalist, Racket News editor-in-chief. He's got his latest Substack article, Open Letter to the Columbia Journalism Review, on the atrocious New York Times. We have been talking about Russiagate, the recently declassified documents from DNI Tulsi Gabbard, and what this means for the future of investigations, the surveillance state, and presidential politics. So, Matt, Democrats are really trying to downplay this, I think, at their own peril, because if it can happen with Trump, it can happen with anyone, including a Democrat president. But one of the talking points is this is just a big distraction from the Epstein files. What do you make of that?
So that's incredibly frustrating to me because I see that reported as fact in papers like the New York Times, and there's no fact that supports that. This investigation, I know, has been going on since the inauguration. We know that that Kash Patel mentioned a key aspect of it in a Joe Rogan episode like well over a month ago. The CIA released the first of these document releases before the Epstein business really crept up on the Trump administration. So it's just the Democratic Party talking point that they're talking about as if there's some evidence for it, but there isn't that I can see.
But they'll continue to carry water for this because there has to be, as far as establishment Democrats and Republicans, there has to be a bifurcation. It has to be an us versus them. Therefore, if you like this one thing, then we have to hate it. And, you know, if you're interested on the true origins of a massive fraudulent investigation like this, then we hate it. And that's bad because eventually the tables will turn against the very people who are defending something this horrific that to them would be unconscionable if the establishment and deep state had done this to Barack Obama in 2008, which, you know, coming out of the Bush years could have been totally conceivable.
Absolutely. And that's what all of us, you know, there weren't that many of us in quote unquote mainstream media who worried publicly about the story. But we all said basically the same thing, which is that this is a very dangerous story. It's dangerous for the reputation of the news media. There are connotations for politicians in either party if this kind of behavior is allowed to go through without any kind of repercussions. But almost everybody who raised those objections was quickly kind of shuttled out of mainstream media, including people who won Pulitzer Prizes, who were, you know, very distinguished, lauded reporters. They're no longer allowed really to have a say. So there is no discussion of this. You know, one of the sort of old hand reporters that I was talking to the other day said, this is the journalistic too big to fail.
Exactly right. More of that with Matt Taibbi on his Substack and his podcast with Walter Kern, America This Week. Matt, thank you so much.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hello, and welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. You're like, Brian, your voice sounds so ladylike, typically, but today it sounds very manly. No, it's me. I'm Kennedy. Brian Kilmeade's Fox News colleague. And we have a great time all over the Fox News airwaves. Perhaps you've seen me on Outnumbered or The Five or Gutfeld. I'm the lady with the super sexy glasses. And people say such nice things about them on social media and call them a scuba mask. And I really want to thank you all for that because you're so supportive, jerks. So we have a truly phenomenal hour here on the Brian Kilmeade Show, and we're going to get right into it with the man I also love sharing the airwaves with because he is not only a national treasure, he is an American hero. Joey Jones is here, arguably my favorite Marine.
That's a low bar, though, isn't it?
I mean, I know a lot of Marines.
That's fair. That's fair, and I appreciate that. I also don't bring me in this show calling me four letter words. That hero word is that one's. I got to swipe that one off. That's a tough one.
You are heroic. You are wonderful, and you love this country. You are incredibly well versed on the news.
I do love this country.
You have taken your experiences and you have utilized them and turned them into something so inspiring and productive. And aside from your military service, I think that is very heroic because you lead by example.
Oh.
And life, you could argue, has given you a couple of lemonades, maybe taken a few legs away, and you have truly made limoncello with that.
I appreciate that. I really do. First of all, let me repay the comment and say you are absolutely my favorite Kennedy. And so there we have that out of the way.
Thank you, Joey.
I guess for me, life gives everyone lemons. That's kind of what makes it easy to get through whatever I'm going through. As I understand, when I was in a tough school in the military, I'd look around, maybe if someone was further along ahead of me than I was, and I'd say, well, if he can get through it, I can get through it. Or if she can get through it, I can get through it. And I feel the same way about, you know, losing my legs, that kind of adversity. I mean, I don't know what it's like to have cancer or, you know, file bankruptcy or some things that my family went through. I just lost my legs and learned how to use fake ones, you know. So for me, it's always been about we're all in this together and we're all going to get knocked down, have our legs cut out from under us. Ba-dum-tsh.
Metaphorically.
Exactly. Or literally.
Yeah. For you, in your case, it was literal.
So,
and it's been 15 years.
Yeah, 15 years.
So you did a Fox Nation special. I have not seen it. Tell me about it because I'm very intrigued about your story, what happened, and what the progression has been.
If it were a Fox Nation special just about me getting injured, I'd have a hard time doing it and a harder time promoting it. But I really want people to watch this because this special is called Alive Day, The Reunion, not to be confused with the 10-year anniversary where we did Alive Day that was more about me. But in this special, we brought in three men that I served with. They were all in charge of me in one way or the other, my platoon commander, the staff NCOIC, and then the fellow sergeant at the time who was in charge of the operation, the EOD aspect of the operation I was injured on. So they're all EOD techs, and they're all close friends. And we do stuff at my house. We go shoot clay, sit by a campfire, greet each other, hang out, talk, have dinner, and just really reminisce on the guys we lost, how important that operation was, why that operation played out the way it did, how it was a huge success. We basically took this town called Safar Bazaar, and it's where they stockpiled all of the IED components. Wow. So we went in there and took out hundreds of bombs that would have been filtered up through, you know, and killed hundreds of Marines and locals. We found 207 full-up IEDs, functional IEDs in 2 square kilometers because the enemy knew we were coming, so they took that stockpile of IEDs and they made a minefield out of the town. So it became very difficult, but we got through it. Unfortunately, it came at a human cost, my legs being the least of which. We lost Marine Engineer Corporal Daniel Greer with the IED that took my legs. We lost one of my mentors, a Marine EOD Tech Gunnery Sergeant Floyd Holly, a few weeks after me, covering the same area. And I'll leave it at this. The most important thing you're going to get from watching this piece is that we talk about the plight of veterans and the suffering of veterans and the sacrifice of veterans all the time. And I appreciate that fact. It is something that we should acknowledge and want to help out with. But we never talk about the camaraderie, the success, the fulfilled lives post-service. And when you watch this, you see that. You see Jared Scott, Drew Cheatham, Matt Jackson. And with Jared and Matt, it's post-service. With Drew, it's at the end of his career. And you see the success. I mean, they all went to war more times than I did, lost more buddies than I did. And they found a way to have a happy life and a fulfilled life. And I think it's important to share that story, too.
How long after the incident did you start to realize that there was light on the other side and there would be fulfillment? Because, you know, for anyone trying to put themselves in your circumstance, it would seem so overwhelming that it would be hard for a long time to see exactly what you're talking about.
Two things can be true at the same time that seem opposite each other, I guess. I wouldn't say this if it weren't on video because I just happened to have a camera crew with me when I got hurt who came back and covered my recovery. So a few weeks after injury, I sat on camera laying in a hospital bed with tubes going everywhere. I didn't lose my legs. I was given a second chance at life. And the irony there, I was sitting on a couch packing my last bag, talking to my roommate, April. I lived, the job I did in the Marine Corps allowed me to live out in town. So I had roommates and, I was talking to her about it, and I said, you know, I just soon die if I'm going to like get hurt real bad, like lose my legs. And the crazy thing is that changed completely the moment I lost my legs. I wanted to live. I wanted to live for my son, for the people that I had responsibility in their lives. And so the moment that it happened, I was awake and looking down, and the first thing I did was try to find a tourniquet. And unfortunately, neither of my arms were working. One was behind me, and the other one was almost cut in half. But I wanted to live, and it didn't take a lot of effort to find reasons to live and reasons to have motivation. You know, there's that movie Born on the 4th of July with Tom Cruise. And I guess I don't understand that experience. And that's what a lot of people expected out of me, even my own parents, that I'd have this kind of depression and sorrow over what I lost. But it's hard to feel that way when you're filled with gratitude for the fact that you should have died and you lived. And that's why we call this our Alive Day.
So what do you tell people who don't have physical injuries from war and have a harder time overcoming the emotional aspect of trauma?
The first thing I tell them is that they're my hero, because if I know about it, chances are they've asked for help. And that is by far the hardest thing to both acknowledge and do. I mean, I have off screen, because Fox News is not a full-time gig for me. My job and my work is helping veterans through an organization called Boot Campaign and several others. And the first thing I tell them is that is the bravest thing they've ever done, and that they're absolutely a hero for doing it. The second thing I tell them is, let's go find help. Let's go figure out what's going to make this right. Well, if they're just looking for motivation to make that step, for me, it's responsibility. Motivation's like posters on a wall, or, you know, it's like pre-workout. It's going to get you to the gym and make you feel good, but it's not going to get you through the workout. But responsibility, man, that never goes away. And the biggest thing we do wrong in this country is we look at responsibility as a burden, when really it's like it's the receipt for the fact you matter. It's the receipt for the purpose you have. I mean, your responsibility means that there are people in this world that look to you and only you to do a thing or be a person or lead a team or show up to be on a team. I mean, your responsibility is like it's the wake you leave. You know, you think of a boat going through a lake, the wake that it leaves behind it. Your responsibility is the most precious thing, because it shows the purpose and the effect you have in people's lives. And for me, that was a brand new son. It was parents struggling at the time I was injured and they needed me to help. It was a girl that I dated in high school that I wanted to marry one day and get back from a bull rider that took her away. It was a sister that was a single mom and an executive that didn't even have a high school diploma. And I wanted to be there to be proud of her and to help her in any way I could. And so for me, the responsibility of being there for people I cared about and people that still relied on me was more than enough.
That is so beautifully said. And, you know, that there is so much about your experience. And I'm always amazed when I talk to you how you articulate things so well, because that is the hardest thing about asking for help. It is, yeah. It is articulating the pain that you're in. And, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's someone who has served in combat or someone who just feels overwhelmed by their circumstances, but sitting here listening to you, depending on what anyone else is going through, there is so much to be gathered from that. And, you know, I love how you differentiate motivation from responsibility, because that's a new way of thinking about things. And, you know, I think you're right. And it's easy to pigeonhole an entire generation saying, you know, you have a whole group of younger people who really aren't interested in the responsibility. But when you look at it through that lens, when you look at it as a receipt, then, you know, that may be something that drives someone into a life of purpose, if not a life of service.
I think purpose is something we're all looking for. You know, I have this whole like, and I'm not going to go into it now, but I have this whole like theory on these primal motivations. We used to have to go search for food, and we had to procreate to keep our species alive, and we feared everything around us because we didn't have knowledge. And I don't think those urges and those instincts go away just because now food is at our fingertips. We don't feel that responsibility to keep our village going, and we don't have to be afraid of everything. And so we have to, that was our purpose, right? Sustaining life was our purpose 1,000, 2,000, 6,000 years ago. And so I think it's still very primally in us. Like, we want purpose because every other animal, I'm a big hunter, and that's why I came up with this idea. Every other animal on this planet has purpose of sustaining life. And so for us, if life itself isn't something that is so difficult to come by, then we have to find purpose in something. And for young kids, it's the scariest thing in the world, you know, because purpose comes with also being able to sustain life by affording a house and things like that. I guess for me, it's a matter of perspective. Like, for example, responsibility is a dark cloud. I mean, it is something that makes you kind of wake up in the morning and go, man, I got to get this done. But it's like the perspective is turning that responsibility into motivation, turning it into something positive by simply thinking about it that way. It's kind of stoicism in a way, thinking about what you can control and not what you can't. And so the best example I give is when you're stuck in 5 o'clock traffic and you're trying to get to a meeting, to a football game, whatever it is, something you needed to be at 5 minutes early and now you're going to be 10 minutes late. That's a perfect opportunity to exercise this because you can sit there and dwell on the things that made you late. Like for me, it's the fact that when I'm on the interstate, I'm the only one around me that knows how to drive. You know. And for somebody, it might be the kid lost their keys or the car was out of gas and they didn't know it, so they had to stop and get gas. You can focus on that and dwell on that, but then what's the outcome? Or you can take that moment, turn on your favorite, Brian Kilmeade radio show.
Exactly right.
Put the temperature to your favorite temperature. And then
69,
there you go. And then like, okay, so now what are you doing? You're going to appreciate the fact that you get to be entertained and comfortable for longer than you meant to be. And yeah, That's the worst thing about your life right now.
Well,
it's just perspective.
Stay with me because I want to talk about Zohran Mamdani, the rise of anti-Semitism, and what Israel should do in less than 2 minutes. It is the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's Kennedy and talking with Joey Jones. More in moments.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, you're not necessarily with Brian Kilmeade. It's Kennedy in for Brian Kilmeade, carrying the spirit of Brian Kilmeade throughout the entire show like Lady Liberty's torch. You just think of it that way and we'll all be a little bit warmer. So today joining me, Joey Jones. He is a Fox News contributor. You see him all over the airwaves. Fox and Friends weekend, big weekend show, Fox and Friends regular, Gutfeld, he is everywhere because he is phenomenal. And so since you have to spend time here in New York City, and I'm terrified we're going to have a socialist mayor who has made some very anti-Semitic statements, and you could even, like, he implies anti-Semitism, just his statements on Israel. So that's a big deal in a city with 1.3 million Jewish people, many of whom might vote for him, which is shocking. But then at the same time, I think this is going to exacerbate the situation here in New York. You have Benjamin Netanyahu, who says that they're going to occupy all of Gaza in a military campaign. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll do the last first. I am not for war. I think war is a bad thing in any shape or form, but it doesn't mean it's always unnecessary. And I think this is one of those things. I've thought about this a lot, and I understand people that empathize with Palestinians and empathize with things you see on TV. And I don't know everything that Israel is doing to win this war, but I do know what war is like. And if you don't go to war with the intent to win, no matter how ugly that looks, then you don't win. And we have a 20-year case study on that I survived two wars in that we did not win. And so, I guess my common sense thoughts are this idea of a two-state solution is coming to the forefront with different countries. And a Hamas leader puts out a statement that is the fruit of October 7th. So he basically says that is the definitive goal of Hamas that has waged terror. And there's no way in hell, if I'm Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm letting terrorists achieve their goal that they set out to achieve by doing the atrocity of October 7th. And then I think, well, the Palestinians deserve their own state. Well, I don't know. The Native Americans deserve their own state. Do the Christians in Syria deserve their own state? Do the Pashtuns in Afghanistan and Pakistan deserve their own state? Do the Aztec descendants in Mexico deserve their own state. You know, we could go down this list of ethnic or religious groups within other countries that may not like the rule of the country they're in. But you know what? People fight wars and borders get established. And that's how the world has worked for 1,000 years. And the fact that we only care in this specific case study to make things work differently, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I guess the statement would be, if you want your own state, wage war and win it. And I guess that's what they tried to do. And I don't think they're going to win that war against Israel. And I, as an
even
American,
if the UK and Canada are saying we are ready to declare Palestinian statehood,
what are they going to do to stop Israel from waging or winning this war? That would be, I'm not saying they can't. I'm saying, what are they going to do? Are they willing to put their trade collateral on the line? Are they willing to put their own national security and their relationships with places like the United States on the line for that? No, they're willing to make grandiose statements on the national stage that have no teeth behind them or consequence in front of them for them.
And then you have the potential mayor of New York City saying that Israel is engaging in genocide and we have to boycott, divest, and sanction and strangle Israel out of existence. So this is not going to be solved anytime soon. You have to watch Joey Jones' new Fox Nation special. Joey, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's Kennedy in for Brian Kilmeade. Rise above overcoming a victim mindset. That's next.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I would say talk show and tell today. It is the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show. It's Kennedy in for Kilmeade. And Joey Jones was such a wonderful way to set up this next guest. His latest book is called Rise Above, Overcome a Victim Mindset, Empower Yourself, and Realize Your Full Potential. It's a great book from Scott Barry Kaufman. He is a cognitive psychologist. That means he knows a lot. He is the director of the Center for Human Potential at Columbia University. And he has written several books, 10 of them previously. This is his 11th book. Scott Kaufman, PhD, welcome to the Kilmeade Radio Show.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to be here.
Isn't this exciting?
Yeah, it's so good to see you. I met you at your taping with Nick Gillespie. I don't know if you remember me.
But I do remember you. I'm stoked you're here.
Yeah, I'm super stoked. We all had a good laugh.
So let us discuss the contents of your book, because this is so critical right now, where you have so many people on social media who want to not only talk about their victimhood, they want to live in it. But the strangest thing has happened, because for so long, especially people in my parents' generation, if you admitted that you were suffering from any type of mental illness, and if you sought therapy for it, you were an absolute pariah within and outside of the family. And, you know, there was this mentality that whatever you were struggling with, you had to push through it and not talk about it. So that was obviously a very harmful way to exist for the longest time. And, you know, when people started finally accepting the idea of psychotherapy and, you know, in some cases, psychiatric intervention, things seemed to be moving in a better direction. And there was this openness and the acceptance that we could be vulnerable with one another while still maintaining our identities without shame. But then now we're in an era where victimhood is a way of life, and people want to talk about their mental health crises, but they don't want to get past them. They don't want to find the potential or find the empowerment, and your book is a critical treatise on why one truly necessarily needs the other and the positive outcome in order to have a fully functioning individual self and society. So when did you start realizing this trend that people were profiting personally, not just monetarily, off of this idea of perpetual victimhood.
Yeah, you said a lot of really good things there. When I started studying this scientifically, I started by studying a trait called vulnerable narcissism. And it's not something as well known to most people as grandiose narcissism, but most people think of when they think narcissism. They think, I am entitled to special privileges because I'm the greatest. But I started studying this under the radar kind of form of narcissism, which is I'm entitled to things because I've suffered, not because I'm the greatest, but just because I've suffered, or I'm fragile. So everyone should walk on eggshells around me and I should be front of the line. One of the items on the actual scientific scale is if I was on the Titanic and it was sinking, I should get the first lifeboat because I've suffered more than everyone else.
Wow.
Yeah, so
I remember reading that in your book. I also remember reading the distinction between vulnerable narcissism and covert narcissism, which was the Taylor Swift branding.
Yeah. But it's the same thing. Like Taylor Swift was citing my research, I think. I mean, probably.
I would like to think so, too.
So I started to study that, and then I started to look at some of the data. I talked to Gene Twenge, who wrote a wonderful book called Generations about generational differences. And I started to realize that this is the generation of vulnerable narcissism in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of data on this, and I think that you made a quite a good point in stating that it's a good thing that we are open and welcoming to those who are suffering and being able to talk about their pain. But a big point in my book is that we've overcorrected to the point that we don't empower, and so I use the phrase honest love, not tough love, but honest love. So I think we should always start with validation, but don't end there. Let's validate and empower. So yes, something crappy probably happened to you. Tell me your story. I want to hear your story. And you know what? You got this. It's the resiliency part that we're not teaching our young people, and which is what I try to teach at Columbia through my Science of Living Well class.
And how do you find the environment at Columbia, considering what most people know about it, which is, the pro-Palestine protests that have eclipsed pretty much everything else at the school. And it's very easy to portray Columbia as one of these declining academic bubbles, which only encourages socialism and feelings above objective truths. So as a cognitive psychologist and a social scientist and a neuroscientist, how do you exist in an environment if it is feelings-based?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I'm invested in bringing peace to this campus. Like, so there was a New York Times article that came out about the listening tables that I was part of, for instance, at Columbia, where I tried to moderate discussions between people with very different political views. And I can't say it always went well. I mean, as they write in the article there, the New York Times reporter happened to be there the one day. It didn't go that well. Of course, that's what always happens. But, there was... It takes two to tango, and I know that's like such a trite thing to say, but if one person's good faith and the other person is the exact opposite of good faith, you could have the best moderator in the world with all the best intentions, and it's really hard to get a good conversation.
It's the prisoner's dilemma.
You are so smart. Yes, it is. It is the prisoner's dilemma. I don't think anyone has brought that up to me, but that's exactly what it is in a lot of ways. I mean, you need two people to cooperate in a way where even if they completely hate each other, even if they completely disagree with each other, they're like, okay, I'm here to understand. I'm not here to be right. And unfortunately, it's pretty rare these days to find conversations that are honest and loving. Loving in the sense you don't have to love the person. Love, in my view, is a sort of an adverb. You know, it's not necessarily a feeling. It's an attitude where you're like, I'm here to understand. I'm here to see what your perspective is, and that's what I'm committed to. But I can't say it's easiest. Yeah.
No, especially when you have been conditioned to think that the person who has come to the opposite conclusion, although it might not be the opposite, it might just be different, but we have been conditioned to think that those people are bad, that the one objective truth is the person who stands in opposition to what I believe, they are a bad person. I am on the side of truth. They are on the side of evil. And overcoming that, I think, is scary for people because there has to be an admission. If it is zero sum, And, you know, it's either everything I believe is completely right. And if it's not, if there are some cracks in my logic, then that might mean that the whole thing would fall apart.
Yeah. And people get really defensive. If you really want to put people on the defensive, ask the question I ask all the time, which is, have you considered maybe there's some bias on your own side? You know, I love asking that question, but that's not a good way of making friends at cocktail parties.
Because if you admit that, then that's also saying, you know, if you say, yes, I do suffer from bias and confirmation bias, therefore, you know, my argument may be really flimsy. And if it's flimsy, then it is like the Titan submersible that imploded because it was made of an exoskeleton that was susceptible to cracks.
Yeah, but, you know, but to further that analogy, to yes end that analogy, I mean, it's all about the context. I mean, there are contexts in which titanium is wonderful. I won a titanium watch, but if I'm putting it underneath the water, you know, that level of depth, titanium was probably not the best decision on the part of the guy who did that. So I just wanted to yes end your analogy and say, like, you know, I'm a fan of recognizing context, because a lot of things that seem like disadvantages, that's why, for instance, you know, the whole talk about privileges and advantages, disadvantages, I actually think we need a more nuanced discussion of all that, because I think a lot of things that may seem like disadvantages can actually be advantages in certain contexts, and some things which appear to be advantages can actually, in certain contexts, be conducive to mental illness. So I think we just need a more expansive way of talking about this stuff.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's an easy way to get entrenched in these issues. And then when you're entrenched, like, you don't want to stick your head up because you don't want to get shot. I do want to move on to how you move out of the victim trench warfare. And, you know, how do you find the light and the gratefulness and the gratitude that you write about? And you have a quote from Rumi in here that I love. The wound is the place the light enters you. So, you know, if people are existing with a gaping wound saying, do you see this? Do you see what I have to live with every single day? Whereas if you turn it around and say, yes, but without that, you would not have the opportunity to examine what's going on and allow the light to enter. How do we get to a point where we are grateful for the experiences that we've had so we can move beyond them and use what we've been through and move beyond to something that was beyond our grasp before something like this happened, whatever the this is?
Yeah, you're asking really good questions. And, you know, that is half of the book. The first part of the book is all about the victimhood stuff and overcoming the ways you get where you get in your own way. But the second half is all about finding the light within. And I think where you put your attention really is where you put your life. Irving Yalom, my favorite existential psychotherapist, said, sooner or later, you have to give up all hope for a better past. And that quote basically encapsulates the point in my book. Yes, terrible things happen, but to all of us, really. I mean, I have a section in my interest that warning you might have a case of life, you know?
Yes.
There are a lot of givens of human existence. It's like almost as if some people didn't get the memo that you're not supposed to be happy all the time. And that moments when you feel anxious or you feel upset, it doesn't mean you need to go into panic mode, you know? I think a lot of it is really realizing that there are parts of you that aren't broken. There are parts of you that weren't traumatized. There's a whole science of character strengths. You should take my class at Columbia, The Science of Living Well. I give you open access to my class, Kennedy.
I would love it. That sounds incredible. I mean, I would love to explore some of the things that you're talking about and dive deeper into them, you know, if for no other reason than just to understand this moment and the human condition that we're in right now.
Yeah, I mean, we all have character strengths we can build on. We all have deep reservoirs of resiliency. There's a burgeoning field within the psychology research called post-traumatic growth that I am a big fan of, showing that we can actually grow from our traumas in all sorts of ways if we're open to it and able to process what we're doing in a productive way. There's productive rumination, and then there's non-productive rumination. And I want to get people towards a state where I'm not saying forget. I'm not trying to be an a-hole here, right? I'm not saying like, forget about your past. Just stop complaining. That's absolutely not my vibe. My vibe is like, I feel you. I hear you. And do you know there's so many ways, like you can't change the past. You can't, I mean, as much as we may want to, barring a time machine, we can't do that. So what can we do, given that this has happened, to move forward with hope, agency, intentionality, and compassion?
And I think that is hopefully the next movement where people place their energy, because when the energy is forward-looking, you're absolutely right. You're not shutting yourself off from the past and trying to understand it. And that was one of the things that my therapist, Marsha Linehan was my therapist in Seattle in the late 90s. And, you know, that was one of the things was rumination and going back, you know, in anxiety, when you live in anxiety, going over the same thing over and over again and breaking that pattern to create new ones and to create new avenues of growth. And it's tough. You know, it's really tough when you try and do that in therapy. But when you are in therapy, you are not doing it alone. But, you know, I hope that your book is a beacon for people who have suffered to know that there is something greater that can happen in their future if they internalize some of these principles.
Yeah, it's kind of like yes ending life. That's an improv game, you know, yes end. So for me, I put forward an empowerment mindset. And that's what I want to really help cultivate in people. So it's things like, yes, something has happened and it has affected me and it doesn't define me would be one of the items on my scale for empowerment. I have deep reservoirs of resiliency within me and can handle difficult situations. We should be teaching people they can handle difficult situations, not that they can handle difficult. I think we coddle too much. There's two approaches I don't like. I don't like the extreme coddlers and I don't like the extreme pull yourself up by the bootstraps either, really. I like this sort of honest love, as I said. It's a yes and. It's like, yes, context matters. Yes, something terrible happened and you can handle it.
Yes, I think that is yes and. That is beautifully said. I'm going to go home and I'm going to have conversations with my daughters about, you know, the thoughts that occurred to me as I was reading your book. Again, it is Scott Kaufman, Rise Above, Overcome a Victim Mindset, Empower Yourself, and Realize Your Full Potential, because there's so much there than you ever dare dream. I toured concentration camps and sites of the Holocaust's atrocities in Poland just a couple months ago. And hearing about survivors and their stories, and you know the justification and the impetus for living after that, it really solidifies what you are saying. And you know, life after incomprehensibility, a good life is very possible. Scott Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rise above, baby. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. It is Kennedy in for Kilmeade. And we have more in mere seconds. Stay with us.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Makes me want to puke, Stuart. That's how I feel about that. Listen, these are college kids. They've never probably had a job in their lives. They've grown up probably coddled, reading books about how the world is, but they've never been in the real world. I don't like any government where it disincentivizes initiative, working hard, and that's what socialism does. Like, I'm all for, you know, taking care of people and trying to give back, but you know what entrepreneurs do? They create jobs, they create livings, they create wages. I just fundamentally look at the world. Socialism doesn't work.
The wise words of modern day philosopher Dave Portnoy. also the founder of Barstool Sports. That was from Stuart Varney, and he's absolutely right. And that's the problem with the people who are attracted to Zoran Mamdani's socialism, is it fails utterly, and you cannot rely on someone who's going to offer you free stuff when making things free makes them really, really expensive. But he hit it right on the head. You've never lived in the real world. I don't trust any system that encourages people to not work. I couldn't have said it better myself. I'm glad Dave Portnoy said it. When we come back, Emily Campagno on the greatness of her being Brian Kim.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hey there, it's Kennedy on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Brian Kilmeade has knitted himself a cashmere coat of glory. He has draped it across his manly shoulders, and he is traipsing about the land, making new friends, creating new memories, and he will share with you his stories when he returns next week. For now, for this brief, fleeting, wonderful, and nearly perfect moment, you have me. And I have Emily Campagno. She is the co-host of Outnumbered on the Fox News Channel. It airs noon o'clock in the East, 9 o'clock a.m. on the West, where my brother and sister-in-law have their coffee, and they spend every Oregon morning with Emily Campagno, who is a ray of sunshine and hope in these dark and cloudy times, these rough seas. She is a steady hand on the tiller. I don't know if tillers are on boats.
I'm a deckhand, a sunny deckhand.
She's a sunny deckhand. She's swabbing the poop deck with a smile. And I am so happy to have her in my life and on this show right now. Emily Campagna, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Same, buddy.
That's right.
How fun.
This is
it's
amazing.
It's a takeover. It's a bestie takeover of Kilmeade's show. We're never going to be asked back, but for now, it's glorious.
That's all that matters.
And I thought about the camp song as you were saying that. Make new friends, but keep the old. One is silver and the other is gold.
One is bronze. We ignore them.
Copper is getting expensive. You might be stolen if you're copper. If you're gold, buy gold. Roslyn
Capital. I love gold and silver. I asked my beloved if we should get a safe. So maybe it will encourage us to buy gold and silver.
And the answer, dear public, is he said yes, and they did get a safe. So everything in Kennedy's home is locked up.
Tightly and brightly. Some people who should be locked up are filled with paralyzing rage. And I say it's paralyzing rage because they're really, really mad, and they cannot function in the rest of their lives because of their anger. So what are they doing? They're taking to the streets in Minneapolis, and they're smashing watermelons. Listen to this this irrational rage-a-thon.
It was everything I could have ever dreamed and hoped for.
What were you thinking about when you were smashing? What did you smash?
The patriarchy.
What were you smashing the anger out for today?
Everything, you know, like our rights being taken away slowly but surely.
Many trans friends that are afraid to even walk outside.
You, Trump! You!
That's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's where they are. So it's video of people like angry, shouting, smashing watermelons like they're human heads. Is this the most productive way to spend your time when you are maybe politically, philosophically opposed to the sitting president of the United States who's already survived two assassination attempts?
Going with a hard no on that.
Are you? You're not a maybe? I thought you might be a maybe.
Yeah, I thought about it for not any time at all and came to the conclusion that this is a concrete no. My first thought whenever I hear this dribble is just get a job, right? Get a job. be productive in some way. The luxury.
Get an exhausting job.
Right?
So you don't have time to think about this stuff and indulge your little whims and make yourself mad all day long.
Yes. It is a luxury to skip down the street and purchase a watermelon and then beat it and then claim that you are smashing the patriarchy when, by the way, at least on the West Coast, smashing is a different synonym for a verb. So it's a synonym for a different verb that we can't talk about on air. So they just sound ridiculous to my mind.
Is
saying
that like procreation?
Smashing. Yes.
Yes.
So they're smashing the patriarchy.
See,
awesome.
We had mashing.
Wear protection.
That was our euphemism for kissing a boy on the weekend.
Oh,
yeah. Mashing. We mashed.
That's cute.
Did you mash with Gavin? Yeah, we mashed.
So I just think that this is something that, as we see, it's trending. It's for clicks. It's for likes. It's for the airtime. And it's not productive, to your point. So if you really have an issue, if you feel you cannot walk on the streets and you're transsexual, why is that? Is it because Minneapolis doesn't support law and order? Is it because the prosecutors don't actually prosecute crimes? Was there a hate crime that we've seen? I haven't heard of one. So all of these.
Was there an unhinged, mentally ill, homeless drug addict who maybe attacked someone for the way they looked? And in a city that is super lax on bail and prosecution, maybe that person was given a desk ticket and encouraged to go back out and reoffend and hurt or spit on or taunt another person.
Plus, when you're doing it in public like that, it's so obvious that you're attention seeking, because then what happens? Is it the hardworking city employees who come and clean it up? Right. And then in that case, isn't that sort of exhibiting that same caste system that these pretend rageous are against? Because that's what's happening. I don't think that they're probably cleaning up afterwards. So someone else is.
I smashed the patriarchy.
And I ate the watermelon. Also, the fact that you and I buy whole watermelons, not halves anymore.
No way.
And you and I cut them up and we eat them every weekend. So to me, this is also just straight up waste.
Yeah.
Just waste, fraud, and abuse of the watermelons.
So talking about other people whose brains have been scrambled, what do you make of the Texas Democrats? Because this has been a pretty massive story. They thought that they would leave the Texas state legislature and go to Illinois, because I guess that's what you do when you're in a Lone Star pickle. And now they're under threat of arrest. Are you talking about this today on Outnumbered?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Come on, feel the noise, Illinois. So I have that T-shirt, by the way, everyone. I used to live in Decatur. Yeah, I think
Decatur?
It's
Decatur. I don't even know her.
I think it's stunting masquerading as statesmanship. So these guys are claiming that there's a threat to democracy, and yet they are totally absconding away from their duty legislatively to actually get something done in the building. So they're claiming that the worst thing possible can happen to the republic, to democracy, and so their answer is to flee their elected job, to flee their constitutional duty. I think it's very apt that the governor is calling for the arrest and also for the prosecution of bribery, if indeed they're taking money to do this done. And the irony, you know, Democrat Texas Ann Johnson 2 days ago now, or yesterday in the morning, was on a show claiming, well, this is the very last tactic. Times are extraordinary. This is the only thing we have left. To which the host reminded her, well, you did this in 2021 too. And weird, then it didn't work either.
Yeah.
And so then Democrat Texas Congressman Ann Johnson sort of flustered around and came up with a totally inapplicable football analogy, and then said, well, it's up to Texans. They have to know, does their governor serve President Trump or does he serve Texans? So it all comes back to a pushed narrative where it's either Trump is orange man bad or it's and anything we do is positive. But at the end of the day, they are totally annihilating any respect afforded to them or any honor of that office. And
well,
I hope all of them are primaried.
If they serve Texans, is it really best to fight in another state if you are trying to protect the rights of your constituents?
No, that's the point. They're fleeing to this like bestie's house only for the TikTok likes. And some of the criticism of the gerrymandering, when you actually get into it, is sort of humorous to me too, because it talks about how, well, conservative Hispanic Democrats are now going to outweigh the Democrat Hispanics along with white voters. And it's like, well, that's what we saw in 2024. So essentially what the application of this gerrymandering, and some critics have noted it could be a lot uglier, meaning they recognize that actually this isn't some type of terrible, horrible, racist thing, because it was racist to begin with to assume that all Hispanics vote Democrat. It's racist from the beginning to assume people of certain colors vote in monolithic ways. And so here there we saw that obliterated in the actual election, and then we're seeing that put to application here. So I think California has a lot to answer for also. But
they're threatening to do this to an even greater degree
exactly.
in California and do whatever they can. But they've already lost. And I was thinking about that because, you know, Gavin Newsom's like, yeah, we're going to do the same California. You know, you mess with the bull, you'll get the horns. Mm-hmm. But they already lost a House seat because of depopulation, because people are fleeing the state, and he's making it less and less attractive. That's another thing I want to talk about, which is so shocking to me, is Kamala Harris. And it's not shocking that she's running away from a fight because she's not a very good fighter, but that her excuse for not running for governor of California is the system is broken. What system is she talking about? Is it the broken system that Gavin Newsom will hand her that has been an invitation for people to flee from California to the point where it's almost impossible to get a U-Haul out of the state? Is it the system that the Democrat Party in California has constructed over the last few decades, giving their party the supermajority? So what is it about the broken system? Is it because she lost the presidency? Because the system was so broken, it just inserted someone on the Democrat presidential ticket instead of having a quick primary? What system is she talking about?
I don't know. I mean, I think at the end of the day, she's unintellectual and she's not intellectually honest, because the reality is, you're right, she benefited. Whatever broken system she's talking about, she directly benefited.
Amen.
And I don't think the system is broken at all, actually, because that was the whole point, that the voters took back the power and they responded to the option of a totally inept and frankly, corrupt Democrat Party and potential president at the helm. And they said, no way, not on our watch. It was a very effective, I thought, message to her. So when the Democrat Party is sort of, again, conducting this like autopsy, I'm like, well, I don't even think you need an autopsy, man. Just look in the mirror. I think it's pretty obvious that everything you guys stood for ideologically, in addition to the blatant corruption of installing a presidential candidate against any voter's will whatsoever, it didn't work. It totally failed. And I think, too, that this whole like OK corralling that she is in the middle of now with a president, where allegedly they're sort of threatening to like release either Palin-esque moments from Kamala, or she's threatening to sort of expose President Biden in terms of his mental unfitness. I mean, that to me just also shows it was never about leadership. It's just about reputation protection. They are trying to manage their reputations. And if that's true, too, as we are discussing how she is completely intellectually dishonest and also not that bright and totally lying as well. So now you're telling me, well, if he was so unfit, why did you stay quiet? And Biden, if you knew Kamala was an empty vessel, then
why'd you pick her in the first place?
Why'd you elevate her? He told us she was the future of the Democrat Party.
Yes.
So you're either lying then or you're lying now.
And he was a one-term president who was going to act as a bridge.
Right. Well, and now he's just a walking, talking crypt keeper.
Yeah.
It is frightening. Both of them are frightening.
She walked all over him, but she didn't have the skill set to meet her ambitions in order to make a convincing case to voters why she should be the one who's negotiating with Ukraine and Russia. Why she is the one who is having discussions with Thailand and Cambodia. Why she should be the one to have conversations about tariffs with the EU. Can you imagine her in any of these positions?
No, because we were made aware, for example, of at a certain point during her vice presidency, when a bunch of intelligence community reports and briefs were put in front of her. And the only comment she had was apparently how an officer had referred to a female leader or a female subject in the report. So, and then that then started this whole, here's how you have to refer to females and whatnot. So what I learned from that as an American citizen, I mean, not that it needed to be underscored, but yes, was that our vice president was intellectually totally ill-equipped to handle any modicum of role in the vice presidency. And usually people say, oh, the vice president, you know, that really does nothing. No, it's a big, important role, actually. It's a very important role. And she was really close to the actual presidency, as mm-hmm. we saw our commander-in-chief totally decline. So to learn that someone who was so unintelligent, she didn't pass the bar on the first time. We've seen how she communicates. We now learn how she takes constructive intelligence community intel and just DEIs it. Mm. I mean, that's absolutely horrifying to me how close we came to total annihilation, because that's what would have happened if she had assumed the leadership position.
Very quickly, before I let you go, because I know you have to go right to the outnumbered couch. Who was a worse pick for vice president, Kamala Harris or Tim Walz?
Oh my gosh, that's the hardest would you rather of all time. Gosh, I'm going to say her. He is a blowhard, but I think he has like one more brain cell than she does. I think he's a tiny bit smarter.
Okay, here's an even better would you rather. Would you rather be stuck in a car every single weekday morning on a 2-hour commute with Kamala Harris or be married to Tim Walz?
Oh gosh! I can't. Don't make me do it. Don't make me pick. I mean, I think I would have to pick Kamala, obviously, unless I could divorce Tim Walz immediately. But I know that's not the rules of would you rather. You have to accept the thing. So I would say Kamala Harris, and then I would just slash the tires and take the bus. And on that note.
On that workaround, go have a phenomenal show. We'll be watching you on the outnumbered couch. You are the best in the whole world.
I
thank thee in kind and embrace your gratitude.
My gold friend.
That is Emily Campagna, co-host of Outnumbered. You can see her on The Five. You can see her on Gutfeld, the true crime podcast, on Fox News podcast. Get it all, Emily Campagna, everywhere and always. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. More in moments. I'm Kennedy.
In-depth analysis, insightful commentary, probing questions.
What's a furry again?
I'll tell you.
Thinks they're an animal?
Sure.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Information is more like it, because Brian Kilmeade is the man with the plan, and his plan right now is to be anywhere but this radio studio. So it's your pal Kennedy filling in. There was a story in the New York Post about young women who are getting crafty with their dating profiles, and they are now including that they can be better swayed perhaps into the boudoir by a guy who can build their IKEA crap. So it may seem like this is tragic and it is usury, and women are just trying to find a brawny and sexy guy who can put together their cheap furniture because they don't know how to do it. And I will say two things. One, ladies, get a drill, even if it's a pink one, and learn how to use it, because that will make your life a lot easier than trying to use an Allen wrench. And you can absolutely do it. Just separate all the items, follow the instructions. You will be amazed at what you're capable of doing. It will take you forever. And two, this is why we need to encourage more men to go to trade schools, because guys who can do things with their hands and build things are naturally sexier, not just because they can put together our bedside tables and our bookcases, but because there is a need for that level of competency in our society that is lacking. We need more men in trade schools. We need more biceps, and there's nothing wrong with it. This is the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show. It's Kennedy in for Brian. Jimmy Failla is next.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hello, it's Kennedy in for Brian Kilmeade on the Brian Kilmeade Show. My pronouns are she, him. What? I'm not the him. Brian's the him. I'm the her. I'm Kennedalia. And I've reached a curious time in my life where I have two daughters, 16 and 20. They are both delightful rainbows, unicorns of joy and intelligence, and they always steal my stuff. And today, for the first time, I stole my daughter's shoes because I felt like they look great on me. Yep, her Nike Pandas, I bought them. Now I'm wearing them. Tables have turned, Jim. I'm taking back my things and the thievery. Jimmy Failla joins me now. He is the host of Fox News Saturday Night on the Fox News Channel, 10 p.m. Eastern. You have to watch it every single Saturday if you know what's good for you. Mm-hmm. He's also the host of Fox Cross America with Jimmy Failla, weekdays from noon to 3 on Fox News Radio.
Hot damn.
You're almost as busy as Kilmeade.
That's why I'm out of breath. I was making paninis on the third floor again. No, I do everything here. I used to trim Geraldo's mustache. A lot of people don't know that.
That's sad. So when he left, was there a hole in your heart?
Well, it opened up a gap in my schedule with the mustache thing. But luckily, I have a few Italian women down the block. I can't stop it. What's going on, Jimmy? Why are you taking shots at random ladies?
They've been so good to you. I have a friend who complains about his partner, his female partner, a lot. And he's like, yeah, she's always doing these horrible things and saying mean things, and it's really tough. And, you know, it's like, I think she might be stepping out on me. And so I said to him, I don't think I like her. And he said, he got really offended. He goes, she always says really nice things about you. And I was like, then don't tell me that stuff.
Yeah, that's the point. Because they do that familial thing, where it's like, hey, he's an a-hole, but he's our a-hole.
Yeah,
you know
but
what
it's
I mean?
Like, I'm being a good friend.
Of course.
You know, it's like, I'm trying to protect you.
And they're leading the witness here, you know? In my experience, okay, because I've, you know, well, I guess we're married. Jenny and I married 19 years.
Oh, that's exciting. What are you going to do for your 20th?
Ooh.
Well, please don't say get a divorce.
No, stop it. We're way past that.
Ordinary.
Yeah, that's very average. I mean, she did get me a Tinder account for our 15th, so she's got to get creative for the 20th. I don't know what she's going to get.
It was Grindr. Well, at least be honest with the audience.
A gal can dream. Anyway, 20, we probably go back to Italy, eat some carbs.
That's right.
I loved it over there.
Is that where you honeymooned?
What? No. We I know nobody likes a show off, but we honeymooned in Chicago at a Cubs game.
Oh, that's cool. That's actually great.
Yeah, we got married in Salina, Ohio.
Yeah, because back then Chicago wasn't like a hellhole of crime and whizzing bullets.
No, back then, like, a stolen base was a guy stole second. Now a stolen base is like someone's lost an instrument. They've been mugged on the train. Totally different animal. But we went to Chicago. We drank old-style beer. We watched the Cubs. And our superpower, this is true, because since you mentioned you invoked your friend and that sneaking suspicion they have about their partner. Jenny and I actually relax each other. It's the opposite. You know, I've met a lot of people that it's like so exciting.
Your wife is extraordinary.
Cool. Yeah, Jenny's great. She has whoever denied her the self-worth she should have is a hero to me.
No,
I don't know who she dated before me, you know, but yeah, she's fantastic.
Can I tell a story that she told me about something you did recently? That in any other marriage would be unforgivable.
The Viking helmet? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
The passports.
the passports? I don't know, but I don't know that I'm guilty of this.
You threw away your family's passports and your son's birth certificate.
Well, hey, at least you know she's not married to a shady guy. Does a shady guy forget where the passports are? Never. Okay.
You didn't forget where they were. They were sitting there on a desk and you threw them away.
Okay, let me jump in here. Okay. Jenny, for I believe it was like Christmas, we just got a dumpster. Like, for real, and just wanted to throw stuff out.
That, it sounds like the most satisfying and wonderful thing in the world.
It was amazing. We chucked everything, okay? The neighbors are still mad at us about their daughter, but they'll find her. It's not a big landfill. What are we doing here? But the point is...
She's almost four, you know?
She knows her way around. I mean, come on. Anyway, we're throwing out everything imaginable. Apparently, our passports were in a folder that may or may not have wound up in a bag. But here's the issue. No, I stand my ground on this, and I'm sad I wasn't there to defend myself. Jenny was putting things she wanted to keep into a white garbage bag.
Okay.
No. You know what goes into a white garbage bag? Things you're getting rid of. So I apparently put the folder in the wrong white garbage bag instead of the we're going to keep it white garbage bag. But who announces they're keeping something by putting it in a white garbage bag? So that would be my end of the argument.
So my question is, you were in such a rush to get rid of the evidence. Why did you get the dumpster in the first place? What were you trying to get rid of?
Well, not my real passports. I got like three or four you shouldn't know about.
Anyone who's listening knows how hard it is to get a passport.
Very hard.
And ever since COVID, there is such a lag. So if you're going on a trip, you really have to take your boarding pass and receipt and to another state to get a passport if you actually need an emergency passport.
It's that bad because the expediter here is like, well, it's a
expediter.
I know. But they're like, well, it's $1,000. We can have it for you in 8 weeks.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, what?
I had to pay for the expediter because when you turn 16, you get a 10-year passport. Mm-hmm. So one child had a 5-year, one had a 10-year. The 5-year expired, so we had to get one in order to go to the Bahamas, which we're not going to miss a trip to the Bahamas.
No, you're not.
No, this is back before they were, you know, just snatching tourists off of boats and giving people antifreeze in their alcohol bottles in the fridge.
Fun. No fun.
No. So, and it cost like $750.
Is it that? That's crazy.
And still didn't get it like that day or the next day. It still took about a week.
Wow. That's a racket. I've been on both sides of this, but when I needed an expedited passport, I did have to go to Connecticut. I did. Jenny has since gotten me those forms that you fill out, and now you've got to go get them stamped and the picture and everything like that. I just haven't done it yet because I have no international plans at the moment, but it'll get worked out.
No, just wait till the last minute.
It's the way we like to do it in the Fela house.
Like my sexy teenage boyfriend says, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes you a minute.
Amen.
I went to so this is not an advertisement. I went to FedEx when I needed a passport, and I got it in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So I just did sort of the expedited, and they took my picture there, and I have taken horrible passport photos until the most recent one, and I look like a sexy baby. Yeah. It is the most beautiful picture, and the guy had this big clunky camera, and I'm like, this is going to be awful. Yeah. I'm going to look like Rocky Dennis again.
And you wound up taking a glamour shot?
Yes.
You got a hot passport.
And now when I go around the airport, when I land in another country, I'm like, that's me. That's me. And they're like, sir, that is not you.
Do you know what I bet? That's hilarious. Sir. Do you know what? It's actually a win for me, addition by subtraction. My other passport, they used a photo from when I used to have bleach blonde hair. I looked like Lance Bass. Because I was like 30 pounds lighter and I had bleach blonde hair.
Oh, that makes sense because you met him at a rest stop.
Well, the rent don't pay itself. But yeah, I had a lot of flirty customs agents back in the day. I remember in Jamaica because I showed up with that bleach blonde teased bang hair and everybody was a little frisky. So maybe this was a blessing in disguise. Maybe I'm.
So that's the picture you're replacing is Lance Bass.
Yeah, I get to be myself now. It's the chubby before model who's flying into town to eat all your croissants. Less threatening.
So someone asked me, how much gel does Jimmy use in his hair?
Oh, it's a good question. I use clay. It's a sculpt clay. I don't use much. I get out of the shower, right, with wet hair, put a dab on my fingertip, and then like do the rub the hands and just bang it out.
Nice.
So it doesn't lose its form because my hair is short. It's kind of trained. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But you don't actually have to product it much because of that. If I had longer hair, you'd have to be like, you know?
Back in the day, and this, you know, to your point, there are so many products. There are so many options for men and women. And Greg Gutfeld brought this up a few weeks ago. Never in history has it been easier to be hotter.
Yeah.
Like you can be, it doesn't matter who you are, where you live, what you look like. There is a way to transform yourself into being hot. And I realized that we were watching women's golf over the weekend, mm-hmm. and women's golfers used to be a handsome crew.
Yeah.
It was never, you know, you wouldn't mistake them for Raiderettes.
Fair.
Like our friend Emily Campagna was a cheerleader mm-hmm. for the then Oakland Raiders.
That's
so it used to be like women's golfers were no nonsense, comfortable shoes, mm-hmm. baggy attire.
It was Amy Klobuchar. You're using a lot of verbiage to say Amy Klobuchar. Continue.
That's so funny because she looks like yeah. what pro golfers used to look like. Yeah. And now they all look like Victoria's Secret models.
Isn't it something?
Yes, because
Gram.
Anyone can get extensions and lip filler and like great makeup products and leggings and Paige Spirinac, like
yeah.
push-up bras and short skirts.
Yeah.
And if you have actual ability,
uh-huh.
like because it used to be, well, really hot people had to try to find a way to cultivate some ability. Mm-hmm. But now if you have any natural ability, it has never been easier to be hot.
Amen. And there's this primal motivation to be it because everything is so much more photographed. That's what happened. That's where Instagram really has helped with the self-improvement craze is everybody knows they're going to be seen now. So they want to, you know, put forth a slightly better product, you know, myself aside. But I think that's my superpower.
Well, you are wearing a very normal jacket today.
You know what? I was just on with Stuart Varney and I upset him, our mutual friend Stu Varney.
Yeah.
Brian's always on before me on Tuesday. Stu really likes the British bands. So he was like, he bumped in on The Who. And I said, well, you know, Stu, The Who's still on tour right now, but they're a little older. They're singing Who Are You to each other. And everybody on the set laughed, and Stu was concerned. He didn't like it.
He didn't like that
out loud, but I can tell he's protective of his British bands. You know what I mean? You can't take, you know, shots at Ringo, you know? But I love Stu. He's the best.
Ringo will be, and I think you can agree with this. And, you know, we all adore Sir Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
Ringo will be the last Beatle standing.
Yeah, no question.
Because there is no justice in the world.
It has to be that way.
Yeah.
The last two people on Earth, when Earth signs off, Ringo, Keith Richards. Did you tell me Keith Richards isn't going to be here for the finale? They're going to put out. As it turns out, those two have just really wanted to work together since like 1962. And they just knew they had to outlive everybody to finally realize this is their Shawshank. They're going to meet on a beach with a drum and a guitar and crank out some hot tunes from the 60s. I love it.
Do you wish Shawshank Redemption ended different?
Well, in the modern era, it would end different. You want to know why?
Yes.
They'd meet on the beach, immediately take a selfie, and their phones would get geotagged, and they'd go to jail.
Yeah.
That would be the Shawshank selfie, and it ends with them back in the same damn jail because they had to get some likes on the gram.
Oh, God. I love it so much. We were talking this weekend about movies that would be better if they had a different ending.
I love that.
Do any for you come to mind?
I mean, yes. If every single Sex in the City ends with a Jaws shark attack, I mean, who's not? I'd say open, middle, and closes with one. I think, you know, I don't mean to reconfigure the segment, but I feel like I have a lot of support for my idea here.
Yeah. Were you surprised that And Just Like That was canceled after 3 seasons?
Oh, and what they did to it, too, because I wasn't watching it, but I was reading about it. Ugh, because they were really just crowbarring a lot of Miranda's agenda.
Yeah.
And she's the worst. I've driven her in my taxi.
No,
yeah,
Cynthia Nixon?
Cynthia Nixon, back in the day, had a friend or a relative. I don't know. I don't have the answer. But they went to a school on the Upper West Side. You know, there was a kid's school at Columbia University. It was
yes.
called the School at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never been to the School at Columbia, it's every other school. They play all the child games at Columbia, pin the blame on the Jew. It's fun. They do it all up there. And I used to drop her off up there near that school. I don't know that she was going to it, but I used to drop her off a lot. She was such a nasty human being, but to the little people. You know how they say you can tell how people are by how they treat the little people?
Yeah.
Dude, like I'm a cab driver getting all my sleep at red lights. You know, I'm really like a broken man just trying to make it work in life, and she was a monster. I drove her 3 times.
3 times?
3 times I drove her.
Oh.
You know who I drove who was great up there? Susie Essman from Curb.
Oh, I love her.
And she
seems like she's miserable because she plays Susie on
yeah,
the show.
Yeah.
And she just – Jeff's wife.
Yeah. But she does scream at people. Yeah. So in a cab, you know, they're your teammate. and she was screaming about another driver that I wasn't even bothered or affected by. And she screamed for 82 blocks about this guy to our right who was doing things she didn't approve of. And she was fantastic.
Oh, that is such a great story. That fills my heart with joy. There is justice somewhere in the world, even if Ringo will be the last Beatles.
It's close. I mean, honestly, it's probably Ringo and Trump. You know, Trump can't be. It's just there's something going on there.
Hopefully,
I don't know.
Hopefully Ringo will be singing Yellow Submarine at Mar-a-Lago. 35 years in the future.
The best.
All right, Jimmy Failla, Fox Across America, you're starting your show in 10 minutes. Thank you for taking the time, Jim.
This was great.
A hero and a legend. Never mind that Joey Jones. You're the real hero today,
Jimmy. Let's talk about that next time, can we?
Thank you for your service. All right, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We've got food hypocrisy. RFK Jr. wants to take your treats. That's coming up right here, the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Kennedy.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
We all believe in free choice. We live in a democracy. People can make their own choice about what they're going to buy and what they're not going to buy. If you want to buy a sugary soda, you ought to be able to do that. But the U.S. taxpayer should not pay for it. And the U.S. taxpayer should not be paying to feed kids foods, the poorest kids in our country, with foods that are going to give them diabetes. And then my agency ends up, through Medicaid and Medicare, paying for those injuries. So we're going to put an end to that, and we're doing it step by step, state by state.
There you go. That is Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. talking about keeping unhealthy foods out of SNAP. Formerly known as food stamps. And he's right. The U.S. taxpayer shouldn't be on the hook for things that will lead to conditions that are poor outcomes for individuals who will be saddled with diabetes, chronic inflammation, heart disease, cancer, and other things. The federal government should get out of most areas. And I don't think anything should happen by force. I don't think companies should be forced not to produce certain foods or forced to keep things out of other foods. That puts us on a very slippery slope. And there is a lot of hypocrisy here, because do you remember the backlash when in New York City, then Mayor Michael Bloomberg tried to put the kibosh on people buying large sugary sodas, and Republicans lost their minds. But, you know, here with some of the stuff that RFK Jr. is doing, they don't have a problem. So if you're mad about something under Democrats, you should also push back when it's a Republican instituting the policy. But I don't disagree that the U.S. government should be off the hook for most things. And we definitely need to restructure things like Medicaid and Medicare and not encourage people to give themselves infirmities that will require lifelong intervention, especially when the taxpayer is on the hook. He's not wrong about this. I'm not wrong about my adoration for Brian Kilmeade. I've loved filling in. I'm Kennedy.